Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
This is Democracy Sausage, and I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU School of Politics and International Relations and the Australian Studies Institute. Thanks for all of your very positive feedback on the Zali Steggall episode we did recently last week. A number of you said how much you enjoyed hearing about her early life in politics, even had messages from afar, one from Berlin, for example, very enthusiastic about that discussion. You know, Zali Steggall is a good example of someone who's come into politics, I wouldn't say late in life, but certainly mid-career, as has been quite, you know, a consistent thing with all of the teal independents that have come in, mostly professional women of considerable standing in other fields who've come into politics and brought a great deal with it. But people really liked that discussion to hear about her life as an athlete and then as a solicitor and a barrister and then come into politics. And, of course, the very effective campaign to knock off Tony Abbott in Warringah in 2019. So she was the first heel. If you didn't hear that episode, I'd strongly recommend you go have a listen to it because it was really fascinating. For me, I thought what was particularly good was it wasn't necessarily explicitly discussed, but sort of getting a sense of the importance of personal relationships in Parliament itself in terms of how you deal with things. You might recall that when the independents came in that wave in the 2022 election, shortly thereafter there was a bit of a controversy that sort of came and went, but it was around the levels of staff that independents would have. They thought they would have more parliamentary staff, and one of their arguments was that because they're not a party, because they're individuals, they're independents, they need to know in some level of detail about every single clause of every bit of legislation that's going through the parliament in order to know which way to vote. Now, the parties obviously have pooled resources and they can advise each other. When the bells ring, MPs come rushing from their offices into the chamber and mostly they just vote according to the way their party is voting. The independents, they want to know about those things in a detailed way. So they were quite worried that the reduction in staff would adversely affect them. But the government said, no, they're not going to have, I think it was 8 staff they were saying they wanted per independent. I think they ended up with 4 from memory, which was consistent with, you know, past practice. But nonetheless, what we got from Zali Steggall, among other things, was the way in which they tend to now cooperate. And it was a very kind of measured process where they would have meetings to discuss legislation and have briefings from both the government and from the opposition, from officials sometimes, from stakeholders. There would be no discussion about which way they would vote as independents when it came to the matter, but they would be able to pool their resources in order to get across all that level of detail. And just reminded me that, you know, politics, like other workplaces, those personal relationships really count. Now, this week, well, we couldn't really go past the issue of immigration because shortly after Zali Steggall left the studio on Tuesday of last week and went back across the lake into Parliament House, they found out that the government had this new rather draconian legislation in relation to people who the government was trying to deport, having found that certain people didn't have a claim for asylum, weren't refugees according to the definition, and thus needed to be deported. And the government found that it could not deport people who did not cooperate with their deportation back to the country of origin. Now, The legislation was given to the parliamentarians, to the opposition, to the crossbench on a Tuesday. It was voted on in the House on that Tuesday, and then it was sent to the Senate, and then there it was stalled when the opposition in the Senate and virtually everyone else there decided that there was no urgency, or at least no case properly made for the government's urgency in having this legislation passed. We'll come back to that a bit in a minute, but I think it's fascinating to think about that in terms of this whole immigration debate, which has really been framed by terms like border protection, strong borders, chaos, loss of control, weak on borders, national security, overcrowding, people smuggling. These are the sorts of terms which tend to have framed the immigration debate in recent times. Not so much anymore the positive terms that we used to hear, like safe harbour, humanitarian intake, compassion, and even the self-interested terms like prosperity, cultural enrichment, diversity, and economic growth, the positives of it. So there's a sense in which I think the Labor government's been responding to that negative framing, and we're going to talk about that. Now, we've got a couple of really great experts to do that with. Dr. Demography herself, great friend of the podcast, Dr. Liz Allen, Senior Lecturer in the ANU College of Arts and Social Sciences. Welcome, Liz.
Hello.
Welcome back again. Always good to have you on Democracy Sausage.
Oh, it's good to be had back.
Well, don't worry, you will be had. And it's a first-time welcome to Professor Alan Gamlin, who's from the School of Regulation and Global Governance at the ANU College of Asia and the Pacific. Alan, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thanks very much for inviting me, Mark, and yeah, nice to meet you both.
Yes, it's great. There are so many experts here at ANU, and every now and then I learn of someone, I think, why have I not spoken to this person before? And you would definitely be in that category.
It's a pretty deep bench, isn't it?
It is, yes, it's a good way of putting it. So, look, let me get an impression from both of you, sort of going back before this most recent iteration of legislative urgency that we saw from the government, back to what happened toward the end of last year. How seismic do you think it was that the High Court made a ruling about the people who had been found to have been guilty in the criminal system? They'd served a criminal period of detention, been sentenced and charged and all that sort of stuff, sent to prison, and then the government wanted to deport them, but they weren't cooperating with their deportation, and then there was this sort of problem about what would happen, or there was a dispute over what their country of origin was. And so the High Court intervened and said, well, you can't just detain people indefinitely. They've served their sentence in the criminal justice system. You can't just indefinitely detain them. That's unlawful. That pretty much was a game changer, wasn't it?
I think seismic's the right word. Mm. On one hand, we probably shouldn't be surprised in a liberal democracy that the High Court eventually got around to deciding that indefinite detention is unlawful.
Who would have thought?
You know, the government, though, because the government was apparently caught off guard by this.
Yeah, well, it's one of the things that we, you know, reliably speak to other regimes about, you know, people being able to be sort of disappeared and locked up indefinitely is one of those things that really, you know, we rightly complain about around the world. So, yes, seismic, but on the other hand, probably a long time coming, expected and sort of, yeah, won over the day, finally. Yeah, in terms of the surprise from the government, I guess it's just such a virulently political issue that it's almost impossible for them to have got it right politically. Yes. I mean, you know, they were kind of in a no-win situation there. Mm-hmm. But it's really, you know, the interesting thing about it is we've got this this immigration minister, Andrew Giles, who you have to bet that as the former lawyer for the Tampa refugees, he probably isn't the biggest fan of the legislation that he's standing up to defend in Parliament.
Yes.
But because he's not sitting around the cabinet table, these decisions are really being dictated by the Home Affairs portfolio, which has a whole different set of priorities from immigration. So it's politically a very interesting moment, I think.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting also, that dynamic between he and Claire O'Neill, who is the senior cabinet minister in this portfolio. As you say, Home Affairs Minister, She's from the Labor right in Victoria, and Andrew Giles is from the socialist left in Victoria. And they do have they've sort of come to their respective positions from perhaps different traditions within the Labor Party. As you say, Andrew Giles, one would imagine, is pretty uncomfortable in the role he's now having to play, and he certainly looked uncomfortable in the Parliament.
Yes, he did.
What do you think, Liz, in terms of that? I mean, it feels to me like everything Alan said is right, and it's all part of that kind of cultural framing of immigration that I spoke about in the introduction.
Yeah, and I think what's so fascinating about the realization that, my goodness, indefinite detention is not lawful, and then the way that the opposition took hold of that, knowing that they kind of presided over the exact same thing, it was fascinating to watch, and to watch it play out. I think on social media was really interesting as well, the different angles that people had, and depending on their ideological stance and so on. It was unpredictable, I think, was quite surprising for me. But what I think is so effective, for want of a better phrase, is that what we're seeing here is that crime and immigration are coming together in the most explosive kind of social imaginaries that really tap into this population panic. Mm. And so it's almost as if, you know, we have this red button on the wall with a cage over it, and we flip up the cage and we hit the red button with a stark fist every time something like this happens, that, and then the population panic siren explodes, and everyone kind of gets rallied to this emotive, okay, we're ready to fight. Mm. And so it's the same sort of thing, you know, immigrants and welfare, and they're taking our jobs, they're taking our women, they're taking our homes. It's that kind of social imaginaries, right? Yeah. And so we have, and what better thing to collide crime and immigration? It is like the title of a best-selling thriller novel, right? And so everyone is ready and charged, and everyone has an opinion, and there's not a lot of common sense being had. And so we've got an opposition that's going, we've got a cost of living crisis, but hey, crime, immigration, way better.
Yeah. And also related. I mean, you know, they can tie that whole cost of living thing, you know, it's excessive demand, I mean, housing, for example.
Yes.
Immigration, government lost control of borders, all these things get thrown into the same pot and kind of stirred around into this.
And no one really knows what they're angry about. At the end of the day, they're just angry, right? And that's the politically strategic thing about population panic, is when we hit that population panic red button, is that everyone is charged, ready to go. And it is a concocted fake panic. It is a fake crisis in many aspects. We could argue that. And the thing with a fake and created, manufactured crisis is that then when you have a solution, you are like the Messiah, right? Mm. So it is so politically wonderful. And we see this card being played, the population panic button being hit in the lead up to every single election.
Because it's essentially easy and emotive rather than factual and analytical and sort of coldly perceivable by people. It's, as you say, it's emotional.
It
speaks to fears rather than to facts. Now, that's kind of, in a sense, the populist playbook on most things, right? It's not about solving issues. It's about exploiting issues.
That's right.
Or solving problems. It's exploiting them.
And both sides have played this.
Yeah.
We've got long history of, and we could talk about how the current government in opposition pointed out an issue with temporary migrants, right? And if we look at the temporary figures,
Why don't we do that? Look at those. I mean, because I think in a way one of the problems with this debate is that it's a mix of all of those things we've just discussed, which is the emotive, you know, the fear, the sort of culture of discussion around it, which is as I say, kind of fearful and, yes. and leverages that. But on the other hand, there are sort of technical sides to it which people have a relatively light grip on.
That's right.
That is true. That is true. I mean, I think we've got to remember in the background that part of the reason why the issue is so controversial is because it really matters. It affects, you know, the way we move around in space, affects every aspect of our life. As we saw in COVID, you know, many of the impacts of the pandemic were experienced through the way they changed how we move. So whether that's not being able to walk down to the shops or not being able to move houses or not being able to go to another state or not being able to move to another country, you know, it was all about closing down movement, and we saw how that just profoundly changed the world. So I think in the background, we've got to remember this is an important issue, and that's part of the reason why it's controversial. But then we've also got to, you know, bear in mind that, yes, it is very noisy. There's a lot of heat, not a lot of light often, but half of the noise is people wanting more.
Wanting more immigration.
Yeah. Half the noise is people saying we don't have enough migrants. We have skills shortages.
When you say people, I contest that a bit. I would say, I mean, it's technically right. Obviously, there are people, but it's interests, really. Business, for example, peak business bodies. For example, large employers, certain industry sectors, very keen for skilled migration because this country's been built on migrant labour, right? I mean, our economy, our prosperity has turned on it for so long. In the whole post-war period, it's a story of post-war immigration and the economic growth that has come from it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes, employers also, you know, cosmopolitans, pro-diversity advocates, people who like human rights, people who like the right to move are also pro-migration. But yes, employers want cheap labour, or they want to be able to fill particular skills shortages for professions that people aren't being trained to do here in Australia. Our health system is dependent on migrant labour. And then there's those jobs that need doing now, otherwise the fruit withers on the vine, literally,
yes.
and you need to get somebody in low skill to do that. So half the noise is people wanting more, and then the other half is people wanting less. And a big chunk of that, we had the head of the UN Migration Agency, International Organization for Migration, here last week. You know, she made a really perceptive comment, which is migrants don't vote. So they make a terrific scapegoat for every problem because if you're a politician, blaming migrants doesn't, in relation to blaming other sets of the population, have much of an electoral consequence.
Yeah, very good point.
So, and then there's another aspect of it is just the geography of it. So if we look in the US, you know, typically the more pro-migration states are the ones that aren't close to the border. So the ones that are receiving a lot of irregular migration across the US-Mexico border tend to have some people who are really traumatized by it, in a sense. And they've, you know, quite some time ago started to bus migrants up to the other states.
Yes.
Lo and behold, those other states are starting to feel that same sense of traumatization.
Yes, that's been happening in places like Chicago and New York, and creating and having Democrat mayors come out and put pressure back on Biden to do something in the kind of Republican mold, because they're actually feeling that pressure now anew.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, in a way that they didn't previously, you know, and they were able to make arguments on principle that now it's difficult for them to make when, you know, they have to acknowledge the concerns of constituents in a way that they didn't before. So part of the sense of crisis, of panic, is people having to deal with an issue that they previously thought they had a view on, and now their views had to change. And then I guess the biggest divide in politics today is probably not between left and right. It's between pro and anti-globalization wings within both parties. And you can talk to voters about how they lost their house because of a malfunction in the global market for collateral debt obligations. Or you can talk about, you know, dispersed supply chains leading to them losing their job in manufacturing. It just goes over people's heads. But if you say globalization's bad because of these people, they look different, they talk different.
You can identify them. You can see who they are.
Of globalization. Yeah. So that's what we're seeing in the populist parties, is that they're, you know, they're actually broadly speaking very anti-globalization. They want less global trade. They want less global finance. And the symbol for all of that is migration.
Yeah, but I guess the challenge for that is that in a country like Australia, where we've got a long history of immigration and we have a black history, we are, when we're, I guess, having these moments of population panic, we are turning on ourselves effectively. And so, as you said, it's the other is easy to point out, but the other is us. It is all of us. The reality is that there is a very high degree of interpartnering in Australia. So no matter who you look like or what you think an Australian looks like, it's not the reality. It is not a white notion of who we are any longer. And you could arguably say that it never was. But if I can kind of go back to this issue that a lot of the population panic is not based on fact. And I think what really draws the attention to this is Shane Wright wrote a piece not long after the latest population figures came out last week. And it rightly pointed out that talking about immigration and things like that, we're actually not talking about the full suite of population numbers. We're talking about arguably half of, or maybe a third, of our population balancing equation. The other part being natural increase, which is comprised of births and deaths, the balance of births minus deaths. And this was something that I noticed in the media inquiries I received last week, was everyone wanted to speak about immigration. Of course, they were the headline figures, right? They were population growth rate was up very high in comparison to what we're used to, and it was largely driven, the majority of it by far and away was led by immigration. But when I stopped and I said to a few journos, do you not want to talk about the other part? Do you not want to talk about natural increase? And they go, no, 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 got to go. And then that was it, right? So that's all the media wanted to hear about. That's all they wanted to talk about. And then we're not talking about the other components of the balancing equation, which leaves out a pretty significant part of the demographic imperative of immigration. And so in fact, if you were to ask most Australians, they are unlikely to identify the actual size of the population and the flows of people and so on. And so we know that there is a high degree of this panic without facts.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, let's come back to that in a moment. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I think I will invite you to speak to some of those issues in a bit more detail, because I don't want to be accused of someone who said, no, 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 got to go. Back in a moment.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, Liz, just before the break, you were saying that there was a sense of, you know, covering this issue in terms of the story of the day, the aspect of it that journalists wanted to look at, and media had a particular framing of it. You want to talk about a broader understanding of immigration. So that goes, I suppose, to, as you say, things like overall population, how the population grows, and what year on year immigration stats tell us? And I guess you can both speak to that. And I think it would be really useful to talk about that, because we hear about things like, we're sitting in a university doing this podcast, we hear a lot about student intake, immigration, for example. So over to you.
Yeah, so the latest ABS figures indicated that the population grew the year to September 2023, an annual increase of 2.5%. Now that, if we compare to what we're kind of accustomed to prior to COVID, that's a lot more. We're talking about kind of 1.8 increase prior to that.
That's a lot of fecundity.
Not of fecundity. No, not at all. That's a lot of, we'll get to fecundity in a moment, which, by the way, is the greatest term to teach to first year undergrads. So we know that 60% of that growth, there was a 60% growth in immigration in the year to September 2023. And overall, 83% of the growth in the population figures came from net overseas migration. And if we break down the components and the characteristics of that net overseas migration figures, they are largely due to increases in temporary visa holders, especially those coming to Australia for work or study.
Yeah.
And so you can see that there are elements of truth in the panic. But within that, though, if we then consider the natural increase, it's like a closing down sale, really. You know, the rugs are on sale and they're, you know, we're going out the door. That's what natural increase looks like. 'Cause if we look at natural increase, births are down, deaths are down. And deaths obviously being down is a good thing, but we know about an aging population. Mm. We know the concentration of people 85 years and over is increasing. And so we will expect deaths to change over time. But let's focus on the births bit, right? Decline in births isn't a worry in its own right. So fecundity is what is typically known as fertility in lay language, that is the ability to have a child. Fertility in a demographic speak is the outcome of a live birth. So if we look at the total fertility rate, we see that that has declined over the long term, and we've been below replacement since the 70s. Again, not a problem in its own right. But if we step back and we consider the Lancet publication that also came out last week that showed global fertility decline, remember the outcome of live births, decline in the outcome of live births, we see a picture of something troubling, particularly in a country like Australia, that young people are not achieving their desired family size. So that signals, from my perspective as a demographer, that there are insurmountable barriers to having a family of one's own.
Right.
And this is where we start talking about cost of living.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I suppose the political framing of all of this, really. Mm. But, yeah, go to your point about cost of living.
Well, I mean, just going back one step, you know, this decline in fertility is something that, you know, much of the world is actively pursuing through policy. We think in developmental terms, in development theory, that lower fertility rate is a good thing.
Yes.
Because, you know, according to demographic transition theory, as countries modernize and industrialize, their fertility rate goes down and their mortality rate also goes down. And we see women entering the workforce. We see, you know, that people reaching their ideal family size rather than having lots of kids that are passing away.
So productivity goes up as a result of that, greater participation, but also so do living standards as a result of higher wages and fewer mouths to feed. And
each child gets more attention from their parents, so that builds human capital, which leads to productivity. So this is
all
this
of which,
is not a downside. We're trying to do this.
Sorry, yeah, so on. All of which then, because the other half of that is – then you deal with the rest of it through immigration.
That's right. So, yeah, and it's kind of an interesting paradox, really, how we, you know, if we add people to the population through births, nobody starts saying, oh my goodness,
indeed,
how are we going to build enough roads and houses to keep all these additional people?
Mm.
We don't have that debate at all.
And can I just say that if you stopped immigration, Australia's total population would still grow in the short term. So we would still grow even in the absence of zero net overseas migration.
That I am surprised to hear, given what you just said before about not being at replacement level.
Mm.
So explain.
So, we definitely need to come back to this.
Yes, yes. Now we'll come back to Alan, but yeah, I just need to understand
so,
that. Yeah.
So, again, it comes back to the population balancing equation, that there are these components of growth coming from natural increase, that is the balance of births and deaths, and immigration on the other side. So we are not currently depopulating. So we're not declining. Our births are not being overrun by deaths, the number of deaths. That's how we would
So if you measured our current, just if for the sake of an argument, you measured our current fertility rate
yes.
against, say, a historical mortality rate of,
yes.
say, in the 1950s, we would actually be in some sort of trouble.
So
in terms of we would then be contracting, presumably, because we would have higher mortality rate from, say, the 1950s and a lower fertility rate now.
So
but at the moment, it's masked by, at the moment, by immigration, but also by the fact that we have a lower mortality rate. That is, people are lasting longer.
That's right. We're yet to see what happens with the aging population. And as I said, as the baby boomers really transition through the more senior ages, it is expected that deaths will temporarily increase. But whether they increase more than births, I doubt that will happen. But as I said, that is nationally, we're not faced with depopulation, even in the absence of immigration. But states and territories,
yes, that's a good point, yes.
are experiencing depopulation if it weren't from overseas migration.
And, yeah, exactly, and certain industries would be in critical short supply straight away. Let's go back, Alan, to the point you were making because did.
No, this is totally related. I mean, we only need to look to countries like Japan to see what the potential downside of having an aging population and population shrinking.
Yeah.
You get a deflationary cycle in the economy.
Because they have relatively low immigration, don't they?
Very. less than 2% of the population yeah. foreign-born, you know, as opposed to about 30% here, 28, 29%.
Yeah, something like half of all Australians have a parent that was born overseas, just a bit less than half.
That's right, yeah. Either a parent born overseas or born overseas themselves.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, so, I mean, you look to countries like that and the problem is the dependency ratio.
Yes.
So, going back to my point about, well, we don't complain when people enter the population through birth. We think this is natural increase, as if immigration is somehow unnatural. But actually, it's just the same process, people being added to the population. Now, the thing about people being added to the population through birth, they're dependent for a good 15 to 18 years. And we have to, you know, build a system to look after. Yeah, exactly, as any parent knows. And then also at the end of their lives, there's a period when they're dependent and need
That's
to be
right.
looked after by the people who are in the working ages. So this is the dependency ratio, that the proportion of people who are in those dependent ages as children or as elderly people. And the problem with an aging population is that you get a higher dependency ratio. There are more people who are dependent on a smaller working age population. And so the rationale for immigration is we want to keep the working age population high. So what we do is we import people who we don't have to pay for their education and healthcare costs that get them to adulthood, to being productive members of the economy.
These are skills off the shelf, as it were.
That's right. Mm. And we don't have to pay typically for their elderly care as well, because we carve that out of the rights they enjoy when they come here, particularly if they're temporary.
Mm.
So
they pay tax. Let's be really
clear.
Yeah,
let's be clear about that.
They are contributing to the bottom line.
Yeah, yeah.
We would have a terrible dependency ratio if it weren't for immigration. We would have
yes.
too many elderly and young people being looked after by too few working age people.
The explanation you have both just given is so good, and so I think people listening will be so find it so rewarding to have it explained like that. Why don't we have political leaders capable of running these arguments? I know that's a naive question coming from me, but yes, it's difficult to get across complex topics, but in the end, it's a complex world, and populists will simplify everything, which is the whole sort of project, yes, really. The answers are a bit more complicated, but skilled communicators should be able to handle this.
Well, I think it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about the divide within traditional left and right-wing parties in liberal democracies over globalization.
Mm.
So within each party, you have a pro-globalization wing and an anti-globalization wing. And if you are a politician, you know, political entrepreneur wanting to lead such a party and successfully take it through an election into government,
yeah,
you need to unite that party. How do you do that when you've got two factions of the party who are in complete disagreement on migration? Well, you have to walk on both sides of the street.
Yeah.
You have to say one thing and do another.
Well, I think I buy that.
We see that in policy, right? So we see that what they're saying, the rhetoric and the actual words that politicians use are very different to how they act. And if I can just go back a second here, Alan, I think, was far too kind. I would argue that populist politics are too easy, and that the allure of the red panic button is just too easy.
Mm.
It is just too easy to press. And politicians are not thinking about the good of the country. I'm sorry. They're thinking about the good of themselves. They're thinking about political strategy and their own political survival. And so we keep seeing the button being pressed. And
I think that's a bit reductive.
We've got to give them a bit of, I mean, I think their calculation, a politician's calculation, is I need to be in power to do good things. How do I get into power? And
I think it probably sits somewhere in the middle.
That's where I'd land. I accept the basic point you're making, but I just think in terms of the degree, I think governments, for example, are running generous or you know, what many people, their critics would say, are overly generous immigration policies because they are good for the economy and good for they're in their national interest. So that's the easy thing for this government to do if it wanted to shut down the coalition at the moment would be to dramatically cut migration intake.
That's an interesting theory. I actually take the opposite view. So the classic right-wing or right-leaning strategy on migration is to talk tough and act open. So you need to sound tough on migration to keep the anti-globalization nationalist right wing of your party happy.
Mm.
They don't actually care if you do cut migration. You just need to sound notes.
I accept that.
But at the same time, if you're a right-leaning party, your core, you know, your base partly consists of employers. And so while you're talking tough on migration, you actually need to keep cheap labor flowing to keep employers happy. So
in my own defense, I'm going to make the point that what you've just said makes sense for conservative parties. It doesn't necessarily make sense for the Labor Party. So,
exactly.
So what you've just explained was probably essentially immigration policy under the coalition government. That is, they kept an open immigration policy whilst allowing some of those debates to happen and probably having some of that rhetoric.
Absolutely, Mark. I mean,
this government is in a slightly different position. I don't think Labor has a, you know, desperately anti-globalization.
No, I agree.
Well, the trade unions, the organized labor movement are, you know, they want a regulated labor market, and immigration is a threat to a regulated labor market. Sure. So there is definitely.
So they want protections in it. They don't want people coming in undercutting wages, for example.
Exactly.
And that's where that was, in a sense, a critical basis of the White Australia's policies durability.
Which they don't. That's important.
Let's be really clear.
I agree. Yeah, I wasn't suggesting they were.
But here's the thing is I think my frustration is that we've seen the current government not push back against the population panic.
Yes, and this is where I was going.
And that's my frustration. Yeah. And I think we also need to go back to this issue of the shrinking workforce. If we have a relatively shrinking workforce in that they represent a lower proportion to those that draw on the dependent, right? We then have living standards go backwards. And we know at the moment that the generational bargain is broken. We're not seeing, if we look to housing, for example,
we're not seeing
the living standards be maintained or increase across generations. So that has cast a really dark shadow over what's happening. And we know that home ownership will increasingly become an issue. And can I say I am a forever renter and I will likely give that to my children as a result of my socioeconomic circumstances and those of my upbringing. And that's not fair. We should not have a system like that in Australia. But while we're so busy looking at all of these kinds of manufactured panic, we're not looking at the actual crises that are happening. And that is, in my mind, housing affordability, gender equality, job security, and climate change.
Well, let's talk about housing for a moment, if we could.
Yeah.
Because this is so central to the current heat around migration.
Mm.
And, you know, again, we need to be clear. The housing crisis is not about migration. This is
say that
not,
again, Alan.
This is not the case. You know, it say has it again, very little. Again. The housing crisis has very little to do with migration. To the extent that it does have something to do with migration, it's probably more about internal migration. So
yes.
There are so many other things that are driving our current housing trends that have nothing to do with migration that we need to be talking about. So one is the long-term lack of housing supply, which is a pre-pandemic issue.
Yes.
It's got nothing about a current catch-up surge in migration, which we see after every big mobility shock.
You know,
right after World War One, we saw exactly the same complete cratering of migration and then a huge spike, and then it goes back to
and
trend.
Plateaus, yeah.
So this bounce really isn't the issue that's driving the housing crisis. The housing crisis existed before the spike. So, mm-hmm. you know, in my mind, causality can't go back in time. So, you know, this spike wasn't causing it before. It's probably not causing it now.
Yeah.
What else might be causing it now? Well, you know, you will never find anyone who owns their own house complaining that their house is worth too much. So housing affordability is about renters.
Yes.
You don't sit in your house and go, oh my goodness, I'm paying too much for my mortgage. The value of my property is going up too much. You sit in a rental property and say, I'm paying too much for my rent and I'll never be able to afford a property.
Yeah, now, I'm trapped in this.
So interest rates, because of high inflation, we've had cheap money since the global financial crisis. At some point, we all knew that monetary policy would need to tighten up, money would need to get more expensive, interest rates would need to go up. That is now happening. What happens to the housing market as a result of that? Well, property values stabilize because people can't go out and get a cheap mortgage and bid up the price of a house. So house prices themselves stabilize when interest rates go up.
Theoretically, except that figures came out literally last night. Figures came out from Property Track and from CoreLogic, both showing that housing prices have continued to soar.
But the real problem is the rents. So when you put up the interest rate, the landlord immediately passes on the higher mortgage rates to the renter.
Yep.
So rents are positively correlated with the interest rate. So that's driving housing affordability. Now, there's another big option that people don't talk about enough, which is that the number of people per household went down in the pandemic. Why was that? Because everybody wanted a home office and they all wanted to move out of the CBD because it wasn't a fun place to be. And so there's a huge amount of pressure on a particular type of dwelling, and there's only a few of them around. And that drives the prices of those dwellings up very high. But if we look at the CBD, there's a huge amount of empty space.
Yeah.
You know, commercial office space in CBDs is trading at least a 20% discount. So, you know, the banks who are on the hook for, you know, large office high rises, the pension funds that are where the capital has come for these investments, the insurance companies that have built these major office towers in cities, expecting the planet to just, you know, forever become more urban, they're now on the hook for all this empty space in the CBD. So if we actually look at the amount of availability, you know, there should be a heck of a lot more supply of space there for people to live in, but they don't want to live in that anymore.
Mm.
And with our demographic understanding of what an aging population is, and by the way, much like half of the world's population, we actually don't know what the end of this population transition looks like, because we've never seen population aging happen, right? So we're kind of living it as it happens. But the theory goes that as people become empty nesters, they then have a house that's too big, they then sell that home and move into something smaller. But of course, that theoretically means that, well, there has to be something in your local area, close to your shops, close to your church, close to your friendship networks and so on, that you can downsize to. And so we don't see downsizing happen like we expected it would. We kind of, you know, 20 years ago thought, oh, you know, there's going to be this tidal wave of family homes and it's going to bottom out the market. So there's lots going on here that is going against the theoretical expectations. And I think I'd also point to the fact that since the 1950s, so since post-World War II, we have seen generation on generation have lower home ownership rates than the generation before. So we're now got to the point where what used to be a fringe minority of rental stress or people in rentals that will never be able to own a home, that's now mainstream.
Mm.
So what's happened, if we've got this is a long road of crisis coming, right? We saw this in the distance, we knew it was coming and we did absolutely nothing about it. And now it's mainstream and now it's a real crisis.
But we are doing something about it now. We're complaining about immigration. That's our...
By the way, how are we going to build the homes, people?
Yes.
But, yeah, I don't see any end in sight, speaking as a forever renter, coming from the disadvantage I've experienced. I do not see an end in sight, and there's a feeling of utter hopelessness and uncertainty, something of which I don't think we've seen the likes of in this country in living memory.
Yeah, and
that's troubling.
That is troubling, and it'd be really interesting. I don't say this in any sense relishing it, but it will be fascinating to see how that has an impact on our political culture as well.
Oof,
because it's dangerous. It's dangerous.
And you're really
essentially
dangerous.
Talking about a growing cohort of people who have no stake in the society in which they live. They don't have the same sort of stake, you know, financially as previous generations have had, and how that affects their behaviour, their relationship to the community, to
and we see that social
institutions,
cohesion,
yeah.
Social cohesion is already going down.
Yeah.
So we're seeing the social fabric of this country
and
eroding.
And that speaks to a sort of a political reality that as much as we might not like it, these issues of the mediation of immigration, the way it's treated, the way it's understood, the way it's discussed, are really, really critically important. I mean, you think back to there's a sort of a very significant event in this space is Angela Merkel's call for Syrian refugees to come up through Europe, through Turkey and populate Germany. I think there was 1.5 million of them. Well, we now see, you know, this has really kind of energized the extreme right, the anti-immigration forces in Germany. We now see the AfD, the sort of neo-Nazi party there, having growing influence in both state and federal spheres. So, you know, it's one thing to moralize about that, but it's another thing to ignore it. You know, to ignore those sort of political realities. These things need to be managed well, and that's why going back to I guess, all of the things we've been discussing here. That's why we need good communicators in our politics, people who are prepared to argue for policy and do it convincingly and energetically, bravely and bloody repeatedly, you know?
I think leadership. You're absolutely right, yeah.
It's leadership. That is something we're lacking, and just someone to stand up and say, that's not what's happening.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that politically survivable?
Well, I think I still have faith in...
You've got more than I have.
Let's go back to this earlier. You'd made the call, Mark, which I think is a really interesting one, and I think many people would agree with you that the way for centre-left parties to fight back against the populists is to actually cut migration hard. No,
I wasn't saying it's the way they should fight back. I was saying that would be an easy capitulation.
That would be an easy capitulation. Yeah. And I think, yes. And I think...
It'd gut them.
It guts them. I think it actually guts them. Mm. But it is incredibly tempting. And I think going back to the detention bill that you led with, this is really kind of what we're seeing is left-wing parties, in a sense, aping the strategy
right-wing party. Which is why Labour in Britain won't come out and just speak frankly about what an utter disaster Brexit has been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, going back to your point about globalisation and so forth.
Yes.
I mean, in a sense, those sorts of debates have been framed by the people who are hitting that big red button, as you describe it, Liz. And centre-left parties are very often affected by that. They're behaving within the sort of tram lines of that that kind of politics.
I think so. And if we see, you know, it's actually worked pretty well for the coalition to beat their chests and talk tough on how mean they are to asylum seekers, to look tough on migration at the same time as, you know, removing the compliance function from immigration policy and allowing a huge labyrinth of temporary visas to proliferate so that essentially persistence means you can get through and, you know, employers get the cheap labour they need. So that's been pretty effective for them. Well, what we see when left-wing parties have tried to ape that strategy is they've bombed.
Yeah.
We saw it with Ed Miliband in the mid-2010s.
Yeah.
You know, he was the son of a refugee, prominent Marxist refugee who thought, okay, look, the Tories are just making so much hay out of migration, I really have to sound tougher on migration. So he made his whole political strategy about, called it One Nation Labour, picking up on a really classic right-wing slogan. And people immediately saw it as inauthentic and just a sort of lighter version of what the Tories were trying to do, and he bombed. He completely, that this was a losing strategy for him politically. But if you went across the Atlantic at that time, Obama was really modeling the successful left-wing strategy. So the right wings, they'll talk tough, act open. But the left wingers, when they do it successfully, they'll talk open but act closed. So Obama was, we're an immigrant nation. We love diversity. I myself am practically an immigrant. I come from, my family is basically the United Nations. I'm from Hawaii, you know. People say I was born in Kenya. We love migration. Meanwhile.
People say. Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other nuts.
Exactly. But at the same time, we're building the biggest deportation machinery in the history of humanity.
Well, perhaps voters responded to the rhetoric, because what followed Barack Obama was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And the very sharp populist sort of shift that I think has gripped American politics, and which dictates things as we speak. Look, thanks so much. We could keep talking. I think we're going to have to come back to this subject, because there is so much in it, and we can come back to a whole number of aspects that we've covered today. And I want to thank you both.
It's a pleasure.
You know, for being here.
And we didn't even get into the difference between permanent migration and net overseas migration. That's a whole other story, because we didn't talk about the fact that the government has a permanent migration program, which is one figure. But in reality, we have net overseas migration, a much higher figure. That's a whole other issue to talk about.
Well, there you are. There's a taste of what we're going to have to discuss, among other things, next time. Liz Allen and Alan Gamlin, thanks so much for being on Democracy Sausage this week.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having us.
It's so much fun. We'll have to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the podcast for this week. Look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye for now.